is your founding father.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our Black Petticoat Society Continental Congress after show. Tonight we are discussing episode 308 of Turn Washington Spies. For those of you who just watched the promo for next week, I can't believe it. Two episodes left after tonight. I feel like this season has gone by so quickly. I'm Elizabeth Kirkbride, First Lady of the Black Petticoat Society, and I am very delighted to introduce the lovely ladies who will be my co-hosts this evening. Do we have the lovely Krista?
Hi, everyone. How are you?
Well, and how are you, my lady?
Lovely.
And Miss Robin, good evening.
Good evening, everyone.
We got to see one of Robin's favorites this evening in a lot of scenes, so we'll be talking about Mr. Townsend.
I'm pretty happy about that.
And, of course, Ms. 1776 herself. Good
Hello,
evening, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm just still very surprised that this is, like, the last of our episodes. And without further ado, be wonderful, amazing, and awesome. Amanda, are you with us?
I most certainly am.
How are you
episode that
to
wonderful?
You?
Of course.
So a lot of things, and tonight it's really kind of seemed to be about tying up a lot of loose ends. And so there's kind of a few storylines here that we're going with. Who wants to start? Where should we start?
Well, with Ben instead of Major, I believe that was actually mentioned during our podcast with Ian. I was just so happy to finally see that scene you mentioned.
I think we're good. Amanda, I'm sorry. What did you say about that scene we mentioned?
When Ian had mentioned the thing about calling Ben, you know, by his name instead of, like, by his rank or by his surname, I've been waiting to see where that scene was, and I was so excited, like, there.
And did it surprise anyone else that Ben resigned? I sort of feel like this one was a little, not predictable, but
I think he thought Washington was going to fire him anyway, because when Abe got arrested, Washington had him reassigned, and now he's thinking, oh God, I've just lost the Culper ring, I am in so much trouble.
Yeah.
Probably the whole, I'm going to pee before I can get fired thing.
I agree. It didn't surprise me, and even going back in Washington at the beginning of his career, he resigned, threatened to resign a couple of times, and he thought things weren't going right, you know. And so, you know, it's war, and his charges here, Ben's ring, these people he's supposed to look after, he's the head of, is falling apart. No, that didn't surprise me. And it didn't surprise me that Washington wouldn't accept the resignation as well.
I also like how they did the scenes in the beginning, because they're replaying it again, how you have each of the spy masters with their respective generals. And I like how they keep on switching, cutting back and forth to one another, you know, as they're each relaying information.
That's a good point.
I thought it was a good acknowledgement by Ben that the Culper ring, what it was, is broken.
and probably beyond repair. And, of course, throughout this episode, we see it kind of gain some functionality back. But I, you know, it was good that he recognized that this was what it had been would no longer work in the future because the trust is gone, the communication lines are gone, they're too slow, you know, things like that. And it will take a radical change for anything to happen. And, of course, he doesn't think that's going to happen at all. Of course, see that it does through the course of the episode, which is excellent. But I agree. Not a surprise, but a good acknowledgement.
There was actually quite a bit of fiber. I'm surprised.
And Townsend, I think, is somebody who it's so funny. I love to watch Nick play Robert Townsend because so much of what we get from him, we get through his expressions and his body language and his sort of his reactions that are not really reactions to other people because he's very subtle. But it's also, you know, if you look closely, you can really kind of pick up on what's going on with him. And he's been somebody who has been cautious, but also really sort of innovative in what he's been able to achieve. And I thought it was really cool the way they did this episode tonight where he goes down into the basement and he publishes the paper that has been sitting on the, it's been sitting on the type, you know, and he's just going to publish it and see what it is. And I just thought it was a really neat way for them to show how he comes by this information. And it's funny because I remember seeing the promo and there was that particular shot that was a silhouette of a rider against a night sky and thinking the way that I usually, you know, we always look at these promos and try to deduce what's going to be happening next and, you know, who is this and what's happening. And at first I was convinced that this is going to be Caleb and, you know, especially because of the hat, but I was assuming that, you know, this is somebody, you know, who's going to be, you know, we're used to seeing as adventurous and daring. And then, you know, we see Townsend who's continuing to surprise us, not only in his, in the initiative that he's taken, but he's also extremely brave when he's standing behind the horse and Simcoe is threatening DeYoung with his axe. And, you know, Robert stands there and he, you know, he very easily could have kind of slinked off into the background, but he didn't. And the other thing, too, that really surprised me was when he took Caleb up on his offer to exact some vengeance. I thought that was pretty awesome to really sort of clear the air.
Robert Townsend, I'm telling you, he has turned into one of my absolute favorite characters. And that scene where he said, "It's bigger than me," you know, he knew he was the only person who could get that information to Washington and the camp, and I loved it.
Robin and has known all along.
Caleb's interest in this episode.
Really the only one who put stuff together.
And I think it was important that he was able to put aside his personal things. Obviously, he took advantage of the opportunity to get back at Caleb, for what happened with his father. But he very easily could have said, these are people, you know, these are individuals who really have not respected me or my family, especially where Mr. Townsend has been so kind to Abe and so gentle with him and really has shown him a lot of fatherly affection and has given him advice and has given him support. And he was the one who really told Abe, you know, not to give up on Robert and that he should, you know, that Robert would eventually come around and he should continue to try to encourage him to become a spy. And then, you know, it's not for Caleb. It's a little bit different because he doesn't really know this man. I mean, he's doing something that's arguably quite terrible because it's destruction of this man's property and he's an older gentleman and he, you know, doesn't have his family at home with him, so he's by himself. But Caleb doesn't really know him. Abe had the opportunity to really get to know him, and this guy expressed so much kindness towards him and was so good to him and so encouraging. And then for Abe to have gone and done that, I can see Robert, you know, even though Caleb was the mechanism through which this was achieved, Abe was really, you know, the one who initiated this. So I can see him being more angry at at Abe. So with his anger towards both of them, I thought it was very big of him to be able to look past it and put himself on the line in order to do the right thing.
I was going to say that, well, besides the fact that Caleb is a little bit ripe in this episode, I just want to mention he did say, yes, definitely. But he did say when, you know, as far as, you know, not touching Townsend's father, he said, that's on me. Last time he said that was in the beginning of season two, when, you know, when he throws the axe and he snaps at Ben for saying, listen, you know, about his uncle, about the fact that, you know, his uncle died. He goes, that's on me. And he goes, if you want to get Abe killed, that's on you. So that totally, that rang, it brought me back to the beginning of season two on that one. And how he said, that's, you know, that's on me and stuff. So
I think Caleb's a great mechanism for a little bit of comic relief. You know, there's nobody else that you can hide in a pile of, you know, refuse
or whatever it was.
It's such an amusing bit. And it's funny because a lot of people, I think, you know, I've seen, you know, comments here and there, you know, if people are watching the show live, it's like, is that Rogers? Is that Caleb? Which one is that? I think it's funny that you kind of have these, like, sort of gross characters, or, you know, some that can be, you know, occasionally gross, but then, of course, Robert Rogers, who's just perpetually gross. But it's funny that there's kind of, like, this rogue sort of degenerate to a certain degree on each side. They kind of have their, they kind of have a counterpart on each side.
In the smell
speaking
department,
Robert
too.
Rogers. Yes. Oh, it was just so funny.
Before we, I was going to say, before we change to, like, another subject, I wanted to say I think it was great to see how the Culperin came back together. Like, they had a new renewed purpose, right? And they're like, oh, we can find a boat. And it was all of a sudden, like, once they had renewed purpose, they could work together. And I thought that was really cool. So now we can talk about Roger.
One thing I mentioned last week was that Philomena had seemed to be somebody who was kind of vindictive. And I'm not saying that she's not justified in this situation, because Andre's behavior to me was really troublesome and really, I don't want to say out of character, because that's a pretty big accusation to make, but it didn't seem like the Andre that I knew. But instead of being someone who's willing to sort of overlook that as the sort of the behavior of a sort of troubled man who's in grief, I kind of had the feeling that Philomena would eventually seek some sort of vengeance or retribution for the way that Andre treated her. And it was interesting that it was so funny to see Robert Rogers, you know, kind of waddling down the lane with his tinker cart. but for him to see her, and this exchange I thought was really interesting. And I thought it was cool how they flashed back to show that she recognized who the person was, and that they kind of have this similar purpose, and that, you know, Philomena is somebody who really did risk a lot for Andre. You know, it's not, as an actress, you know, her relationships are probably pretty important in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, being able to make connections and have, people that she, you know, feels comfortable associating with and networking with in order to be considered, you know, popular. You know, we see her in the tavern, and there's all these people who know her, and they're so happy to see her. And so her relationships are probably pretty delicate in terms of, you know, being able to maintain her career. And she really took a lot of risks for him. And I don't think she was necessarily so much upset that he was involved with somebody else, but just the deception and the creepy methods that he took on in order to sort of mold her into this idea of Peggy, that he could, you know, kind of use her as a stand-in and sort of superimpose mm-hmm. Peggy's features onto her. It was really very kind of eerie. So I don't blame her. And this new Andre is not somebody that I'm so much a fan of. And so I'm kind of interested to see what she gets up to.
mm-hmm. I would not have described Philomena as vindictive. I would have said she is a woman who is always out to protect herself, right, to better her status, to, you know, prostitute, whatever she needs to do to sort of get a one-up in the world. So she's always kind of looking out for her best interest. And so I think when threatened, you know, well, you're either going to tell me what he's up to or I'm going to kill you, she had a pretty good reason to say, well, I'm not that involved. I'm actually kind of upset about it. So I'm going to do what's best for me and not die by being a part of this plot and seeing where it goes. That's kind of
wild. Do you think there was a chance that she was really in love with him?
Say what?
Mm-hmm. Amanda asked if there was a chance that perhaps she was really in love with him and that maybe it wasn't just an affection based on convenience and mutual admiration, but in fact a sort of love relationship on her part.
I don't know. You know, looking back at season one, you know, she bunked up, so to speak, with Charles Lee for Andre,
yes.
You know. So I don't really – I think if he had continued to be kind to her and to keep her in the house, I think she would have stayed. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think dressing up like Peggy bothered her. Do you know what I'm saying?
No, she's probably got a cool dress out of it.
But yeah. She did say that he dressed me up like some trollop. And he, you know, she was kind of upset about, I think for her, you know, not so much about love, but I think she felt that there was a mutual respect there. And I think that when that went away, that's what really messed with her, more so than like, this is a person that I felt valued me more than he did. It was more like, I offered you respect. I offered you a certain contract and you didn't sort of come through with your end of that deal.
And kicking her out of the house because you could never be her. I can imagine she would definitely feel really offended like that. Oh, you're mad because I can't be a different person? What the hell?
Right. Yeah.
When ironically,
like you said, she went through a lot. I mean, it wasn't easy for her to get in a continental general's bed, like she did with Charles Lee.
And that's interesting because, ironically, that's what she's been doing all along. She's been being other people for Andre. That's exactly what her role has been.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he's asking her to play another role, and suddenly it's personal. It's not, you know, this is somebody that you need to be because we're trying to obtain, you know, go through with some objective. This is like for my personal pleasure. It was interesting that that Clinton called Andre out when they were by the, you know, they were talking by the fire and Andre's kind of pacing back and forth and Clinton is seated. And he says, you know, this is all about some woman and, you know, all of this. And it kind of made me wonder about, you know, not so much that I don't agree, but just maybe the choices made in terms of enmeshing Andre's interest in this a little too much is interest in Peggy versus, like, this is a situation where I feel that I'm in a position of my proximity to this woman, and also I happen to really, you know, love her. It almost seems as if the Arnold betrayal here is a little bit secondary to him trying to maybe get Arnold out of the way so that he can swoop in and take Peggy. It's just kind of interesting the way that the emphasis seems to be looking here. I want, for those of you who are watching the episode still, I just want to say Ksenia is just so beautiful in this episode. I mean, she's so beautiful anyway, but she was shot so beautifully in this episode, especially at the end when they're coming in really, really close and she's got, you know, her eyes are very teary, but she's really holding it together and, you know, she has to say, I will. And there's that really, really long pause. And we all know as the audience, all the things that are going through her mind. And we know that she feels that her hope is lost in terms of being with Andre. And she's probably recounting all of the things that she felt and replaying all these situations in her mind. And then finally she lets go and says, okay, this is, you know, this is where I've cast my chips.
Can I just say that Arnold is really bad at reading body language? Because he really is. Like, how do you not notice that your wife is on the verge of tears and then not even getting into that lock of hair business?
He's all about himself, you know? Like, he's probably thinking, oh, so taken with the moment of marrying me. You know?
They're happy tears.
Yeah.
I noticed that as when we first meet Peggy, and I'm kind of noticing a costume trend that her gowns have been getting deeper and deeper in color, kind of like the way she's getting herself deeper and deeper into this mess. She started out very pastel, and yeah, now you see her in the. This one was a dark blue. The one at the ball was like a dark, like a almost like mossy color, and. But when we first meet her, she's all in light pinks, and there's that gorgeous powder blue one that's all bustled up when Andre is like, "You're interrogating me, aren't you?" And but she's in the very pastels, and now she's in deeper colors.
And I think we've mentioned that, I think, a little bit in season two with Mary as well.
Yeah.
That, you know,
and
she
was in lots
of pinks too, peaches and creams.
And florals, yeah.
Can I just say, this episode was good with lines, because speaking of Mary, that line that first came up, "Who did you marry?" I'm still figuring it out, right? Like, things that we have been discussing all the time is her constant change, and I thought that was going to be the best line of the night, and then, of course, we get Anna's line at the end with Major Hewlett of, "I can never lie to a man who has never lied to me," or "I can no longer lie to a man," or something like that, "to a man who's never lied to me," and you're just like, "Oh, it's so good today with lines."
It was a very poignant episode, and there were so many things that were being tied up. I'm so excited because we have Cicero back.
Yay!
I love Cicero. And of course, and I'm a big fan of Abigail, and I love their dynamic. So I'm really, really happy to see him when he opened the door, you know, when you could see, you know, the back of, you see him from the back as they're shooting towards Anna. I was very excited because I knew it was Cicero.
It was like they listened to us last week when we said, "Hey, what happened to them being spies and helping us out?" But I was very disappointed about the plot line with Hakeem Baudet. That was just like, oh yeah, he went to Canada and we didn't go. You know, it felt like a bad sort of plot tie up. But, you know, I appreciated that they tried to tie up the loose ends and that they're back in the spy ring, just, you know, having conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I'm wondering for the next episode. Does Anna get that information back to camp? Like, how are they going to do that? Do you know what I mean?
That was a good moment to leave us on, like a dun-dun-dun
yeah.
type moment.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Because mm-hmm. we know what happens, but how are
like
they going
to see it play it out?
Yeah, mm-hmm. like, are they going to... You know, he was really caught. Andre was caught behind enemy lines, and that's how they found out about Benedict Arnold. But maybe in the show, it'll be Anna that breaks the news. Who knows?
I'm watching again the Simcoe scene, and it's funny because
DeYoung is a
Martin
little bit of a
Martin DeYoung is. It's funny because Martin DeYoung is sort of one of those characters where you're like, oh, God, you know. But I thought it was really – one of the things I commented on when I was writing, you know, my post of observations that I do each week that's just sort of like a stream of consciousness, bizarre sort of narrative was how I really enjoyed the way that they sort of planted the seeds with Robeson in the first season and how they're really – at least in some of the storylines, taking care to bring back little elements that they have introduced to us little by little throughout the previous episodes. You know, the whole Robeson thing and the whole murder of Captain Joyce was a really big deal at the beginning. And now, you know, we're seeing it come back and we're seeing all these, you know, we're seeing like these threads sort of coming together. And then of course we have Robeson's really dramatic death, which it was I don't know, it was creepy, like, in terms of like the fact that he was there one moment and then he was gone. And I think that's a really interesting comment on mortality at the time. And, you know, obviously probably anyone would have died having their lung punctured that way and being impaled. But it was just, you know, it was one instant, and, you know, Simcoe can kind of get away with what he wants to. And I'm not surprised by Simcoe's behavior anymore. What I'm more interested in when I watch Simcoe is everyone else's reactions to him now.
Yeah, within the town, everyone seems really terrified of him, as they rightly should be. I think it's interesting to see how Simcoe has become very one-tracked mind, that there's nothing else other than hunting Robert Rogers, and he will raise this town, right, until he finds the information that he is looking for. It doesn't seem like a departure from Simcoe's craziness, but it seems like a departure from this idea of do it. Like, he's just, this is his one job, and that's all he can focus on is this one, revenge or vendetta or right, something towards Rogers.
He said Robert Rogers was Coper, and that's what Andre sent him there to do. You know, he sent him to figure out who Coper was. But, yeah, I think it was, he's been unleashed, you know, and it's just this constant craziness from him now.
I had a question for you ladies, because I have my suspicions, but do you think that Simcoe suspects Mary at all, and he's kind of holding his cards close to him right now?
I do. Her handprint in blood was on the wall by the door. Do y'all remember that from last episode?
Yeah.
And he walked right by it. I mean, he had to have seen it. He knows the gun was gone, and then it was back, you know. I don't know that he can prove it, but I do think he suspects her.
I think he did, because he also said when
Richard.
Say that again?
I think he might suspect Richard.
I think he definitely knows she's involved, because when he comes in, he asks her, aren't you going to ask if I'm all right? He doesn't assume that she doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't come in there saying, Mrs. Woodhull, are you all right? Because he barges in and she's in the bathtub. But her logical behavior when this is going on would probably not have been to remain in the bathtub. She probably would have gone somewhere to hide. So I think he's guessing, not necessarily just from what happened, you know, in terms of being shot, but I think just her behavior. You know, he's asking, you know, aren't you going to ask if I'm okay? Instead of saying, you know, her logical response would be, what's going on? Or Captain Simcoe, you know, where have you been? What, you know, what's happening out there? I've been cowering. I've been hiding. And then,
are you barging in on me taking the bathtub?
And at breakfast, he said to her, you know, if it had only been a certain number of, you know, a certain number of space off, I would have, you know, or units of measure, I forget how he phrased it, but if it had been, you know, but, you know, for a small space off, I would have been dead. And I think he was saying that to her because they're sitting there by the full light of day and she's alone except for her child, which makes her vulnerable. And he was looking at her face to try to gauge her expression. I think he was trying to see if there were going to be any facial tells or any physical reactions that he could then sort of use to deduce whether or not she was kind of nervous about the statement that he made, because all of it was kind of strange. The fact that, you know, if the house is under siege, she's frightened to see him.
But in the bathtub, exactly.
Right. Yeah, if it were I, and I didn't, you know, if I were an innocent, and Simcoe came barging in, I would say, Captain Simcoe, what happened? What's going on?
Right.
Is there someone outside? Of course, I probably would have gotten out, and, you know, of course, I'm assuming that I was actually in the bathtub. But I would have assumed that she probably would have gotten out of the bathtub, wrapped herself in some linen, and found a place to either hide, or she's peeking around a corner to see who's in the house. I mean, this is a really scary situation. And for her to have remained in the tub, having heard, I mean, that shot is loud, and the breaking glass, and Simcoe is, Samuel is very tall. Simcoe's whole physical stature is portrayed as being quite large and imposing. When he hits the ground, he hit like a ton of bricks because he went straight down. So there's no way that he didn't know that there was something going on in this house.
Yeah.
And I think, I think he knows. I don't know what he knows, but he knows that there's something amiss with her behavior. And I think him stating those facts was just a way for him to try to poke at her a little bit and try to deduce what she's thinking.
Yes, and he's going to use, I agree with everything you say, and I think he will wait to use it when it most benefits his means. Do you know what I mean? Just like he's asking for this list of names because he wants secrets, you know? He's got one on me, and he's holding on to it. That's what I think.
Exactly. He's definitely a plotter, and he's not going to show all of his cards until he has the proper hand. Like, as you said, he's definitely waiting. And I think it's really interesting. Did anybody else feel that there was a parallel here between the list that Richard gave Simcoe and the list that he gave Hewlett of the gravestones that were going to be pulled up?
Absolutely.
Because that's what I was getting here, is that, oh, here's somebody who's willing to placate people again. It's so funny because Richard, you know, kind of tries to put himself across as this man of the house, master of his destiny, you know, authority figure, patriarch. And then he bends knee every time, you know, somebody who he perceives as an authority figure comes in and tries to dictate to him. And I can understand that with somebody like Hewlett, but Simcoe is clearly unhinged. I don't think there's anybody in town who is not afraid of him. And I think, you know, if somebody like Richard were to try to orchestrate, I don't want to say an uprising, but to try to advocate on behalf of the town to suggest that, you know, this is a really dangerous person that we need to sort of contain if we can, that people would probably rally behind him and really respect that. Simcoe's headband, too, is just so 80s. I don't even know what to do with it. I'm just watching the episode again.
He's a maniac, maniac, oh,
you started it. Cover idea.
I did.
Okay, stop me. Stop me now, okay? People need to stop,
well,
and
really
that person is me. Sorry.
You know what else? I need to stop with this joke, but he really has his ear to the ground on this one.
Blood on it. It can't still be bleeding.
Unless when he got shot, it may have punctured his eardrum. I'm going to ask Amanda because she's the resident medical person. But maybe, do you think the shot may have also punctured his eardrum and it may be like leaking just a little bit?
I actually think that's why he fell to the ground like that. I think that much noise towards your eardrum like that will, because I know damage towards the eardrum that can cause vertigo and all that balance shit, because the inner ear is actually what regulates your balance. I mean, I could be wrong about this. I usually am. But I definitely think, I don't think there's damage to that. He would probably be way more off balance if there was. He seems to have pretty good control of himself, terrorizing everybody in town. So I don't think there's any damage, permanent damage to his eardrum. I'd say he probably won't have very good hearing in that ear. There's a chance of that, but I don't think it's damaged, really.
Mm-hmm.
Other than, you know, his ear being not here. I have to join one of those Daryl Dixon ear necklaces, except Mary's going to be wearing that one.
He's wearing like a ring bandage. I'm watching again the scene with Philomena and Robert Rogers, and I know that eye patch isn't supposed to be funny, but he's just so, I mean, it's almost like, you know, stereotypical pirate now. Yeah. You know, with his kind of, you know, hobbling along with his cart and his disguise and, you know, his
tinker
hat.
It's the tinker from Willy Wonka. He says nobody ever comes in and nobody ever goes out. My brain works in a very weird way, so.
I'm really excited because we got to see a battle scene, and we have not seen as many battle scenes recently. You know, we've had some pretty awesome ones, but a lot of the time we find that they come at the end of a season. And, you know, this one was more of a short skirmish. But I loved it because we got to see sort of, it was neat to see. I like when they show us instances where we get the intelligence and then we see all the steps that go into making sure that the plot, whatever it is foiled or is enacted, depending on who has what kind of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I love seeing them fight those uniforms. It reminded me of the pilot. I'm sorry, I don't know what it is. I like the helmet with the horse hair. I don't know why.
The plumage.
But it was cool. Yeah, whatever it is. Anyway, Right, exactly.
I have so many of these.
But Hewlett and Anna, that was a great scene. I feel so bad for both of them.
Yeah. Sad.
Yeah.
I thought, and
sad.
It was, you know, yet another scene where I like Hewlett. I think he's very complex, and he's somebody that we've kind of seen. It's a very stereotypical comparison, but he's like an onion. You know, he's somebody that really had a certain, we had a certain impression of him in the beginning, and we've really seen all of these different layers to his character revealed, and I admire him more and more every time he reveals another aspect of his personality and of his, not character in terms of character being played on screen, but his character in terms of his moral fiber and his virtue, because you could tell how hurt he was by Anna, but he gave her the benefit of allowing her to come and speak to him and speak her piece. And he wasn't unkind to her. He didn't take advantage of her vulnerability. Like she said, you know, you could have me arrested. You could do all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was such a sad moment. And he was so, you could tell that he was so crushed, but he handled it with such dignity and with such gentility that I was just, you know, he's just somebody that I admire a great deal. He's a precious character.
Mm-hmm. And she was actually being, you know, she told him the truth. She gave up who Culper was. You know, she told him about Abe and told him she was a spy. And he really could, you know, that could be the end of it for Anna and Abe and the Culper ring. But I don't think he'll tell them.
Yeah, it's a real testament to him as a person because he was, you know, you see him and I'm watching this scene again and she is being honest. And I think maybe the fact that she's being honest now hurts him even more because she's only being truthful with him now that it's all over and now that it's too late, you know, and maybe if she had given him, you know, this kind of kindness in the beginning, you know, or she had, you know, I think to me, he's sort of thinking here, you know, if only she had felt that she could have been open with me, you know, at first, I wouldn't be in this position now, but it's too late and we can't go back. And he's finding it revealed that he was really betrayed on so many levels, not just by Anna, not just by Abe. You know, it's a romantic issue. It's a political issue. It's, you know, all of these things. And yet he doesn't, he doesn't take the opportunity to be vengeful.
And at the heart of it, he still asked, did you love me? You know, that's what was so sad.
Broke my heart.
Yeah.
And if you think all of this stuff is being revealed, if she's telling him things, then she's getting information from Abigail, Benedict Arnold spilling his beans, you know, and so... It's like there's just so many different paths that they can go down in the next two episodes. So I want to see how they're going to take this. Because there's so much power in anyone's hands right now, including Hewlett, too, because of what she just exposed.
Mm-hmm. She explains it all, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, while I don't if he imagine... knows Anna and Abe, you know, they're two of the main ones, so he could really, and he could end it for the ring.
Mm-hmm. Or any of the culpers, too.
Yeah.
I gotta start getting nervous for my culpers again.
Yeah.
I know, it was so nice to see that scene. There's something, I think the first time that we saw this together, you know, where they were all together was the scene during the Battle of Setauket where they all go down into the cellar at Strong Tavern. I will never call it Dion Tavern. Not
I
nice.
Know.
No.
But
was
they all
completely
they all go
satisfied
down,
with that Dion scene? Holy shit.
When we see them all going down, there's a really powerful moment where they're mm-hmm. all finally together. And it's almost like Captain Planet, where they, like, put all their rings together, and it's like, you know, Copper Power or something like that. Or, like, you know, Power Rangers, and they all, like, you know, like Caleb, like, sperm whale, and then he, like, morphs into the thing, and Ben's like, eagle, and, like, you know,
yeah.
like Wombat or whatever.
That way. I would love to see it end that way. The show, whenever they bring it to a close, to see
mm-hmm.
them all together. That would be a great scene, I think.
Yeah.
Even Anna and Robert Townsend and his dad and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that'd be a great scene.
Speaking of coming together, when Caleb rides into camp and he rides the horse right into Ben's tent. That was so awesome.
Yeah, so
get that out of my tent.
And Ben is like, Ben has learned now.
Like, what are you doing with a horse in my tent? He was just like, oh, okay, hand me what you got.
Like, he's all like,
it's you.
It is Caleb.
He's all Yale at his desk, and he's all, oh, there's a horse in my den. Okay.
Yeah. That was a sweet scene between him and Anna at the beginning, too. I just wanted to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And we've seen Ben recently as a little, you know, he's been a little bit hard-headed, and he's been making a lot of decisions that have been baffling, disappointing, puzzling, befuddling.
Ridiculous.
I could go on. I won't, but I could. But then for him to sort of realize that he, to sort of have an insight, you know, he hasn't really been very insightful into his own actions in the past few episodes, and normally he's a little bit more introspective than we've seen him be, or at least there's the implication that he's more introspective. And when Anna tells him, you know, that you ask a lot of people, you know, you ask too much, you ask a lot of people. And
mm-hmm.
he acknowledges that he knows that he's aware of that. And there's, you know, this idea that they suffer because so other people don't have to, that there's this sacrifice. And I think that was carried over in what we saw Townsend do, that Townsend's willing to suffer and willing to take a hit, not only literally to his family, in his father, but also willing to swallow his pride and do what he has to so other people don't have to suffer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I think this whole
experience
has been really humbling for Ben.
I felt like this episode was sort of getting back to the Ben that I liked best from previous seasons, where he's confident and he's a leader and, you know, but he also has the heart, you know, that you see there with Anna and, I don't know, I felt like he was kind of getting back to himself. And he has been off, you know. He's been through quite a bit, but he's back. And especially in the fighting scene, I was like, dude, it's back! There he is! full plumage!
And I loved some of the shots tonight, especially with when they were coming up over the side of the embankment, and there's like that, I wouldn't call it a cliff because it's not really steep enough, but the beautiful colors in the earth, and that, you know, they come up over the crest and they see, you know, the way that the encampment is set up, you know, the fort, the small little fort with the, I'm not sure what you call them, but they're just like, you know, wooden pikes
mm-hmm.
and they're, you know, sticking out, and then you see everybody. And I thought it was cool. And they've done this too in other scenes. Like the one I'm thinking of now is, you know, Simcoe with the tongue, you know, all kinds of things where they
mm-hmm.
kind of go back and forth. But in this situation where the Redcoats are marching in the woods And then, you know, we see, you know, Caleb and the others kind of, you know, scaling that, scaling the side of the fort. And then, you know, we cut back and they're like, oh, the rebels aren't here. And then we cut to the other side. And it's, I like the way that they do that because it's just a very exciting, it's a very exciting type of cutaway to watch.
Mm-hmm. And the scene that's playing now is when they're in the tent with Washington. And just a real quick comment on Washington in this episode. Always with his eye on the ball. You know what I mean? Watch this. You can count on Washington. He always has his eye on the ball.
Yeah.
And you see that a lot.
And we get a sense of, like, what an awesome general he is. Because he's always seems to be, like, one step ahead, you know?
Yeah.
But, what there was something else I was going to. Oh yeah, you know, I would mention that they were definitely working the moonlight in this episode, and I'm such a sucker for moonlight. I really am.
And they're showing that that clip now of Stony Point as they're coming up over the edge, and there's just something really beautiful about the crisp lines of the way the soldiers are situated. And the way that the, you know, the tents are lined up. And I just, and this is especially true of, you know, all of the episodes. The cinematography is beautiful on this show. But I just felt like tonight it was just especially kind of striking, I guess, for me.
I also, I just want to say, here's another cut where they're cutting from the Continental camp to the British camp, again, kind of what they did in the beginning. You know, they have them each getting ready, and again, they're doing those cuts again.
I think it's very effective. And the snow, I think, like, here you have your moonlight, Krista.
Yes, you know, there's my moonlight.
Snow and kind of the contrast between the dark, like the leaf, you know, the piles of leaves and the deadfall, and then, you know, the white snow and then the whiteness of the waistcoats. You know, with the stark trees behind, just really, really beautiful shot tonight.
Always.
I think we're going to end a little bit early this evening. I wanted to mention our contest before we do our closing. Every week we give away a beautiful piece of jewelry created by Kimberly Walters. She has a shop called K Walters at the Sign of the Gray Horse. If you go to our website, blackpetticoatsociety.org, and go to our tab for Friends of BPS, you'll see the link to both her official website and her Etsy shop there. She's been kind enough to donate some of the pieces that we have been giving away throughout. We've been giving away a piece each week for season 3, and she makes beautiful pieces. They are 18th century accurate and appropriate, so if you're a reenactor, you can be confident that you will be both in style and period correct, but also they're just beautiful pieces you can just wear anytime. So every week we, Krista, our lady in Philadelphia, posts a coded message, and she'll give you instructions on how to solve the message. If you solve the message first, you'll get 5 extra chances to enter, but everybody else gets to enter the drawing as well. The post, so once that's solved, we reveal the piece of jewelry that's going to be given. We do that on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Tumblr. And so you can comment on the post on Facebook. You can retweet or you can reblog on Tumblr. And when you do that, that's an entry into the drawing to win. And so we want to announce this week's winner. Karen, would you like to tell us who it is?
Drum roll. Drum roll.
I can't hear Karen.
Uh-oh.
Right now.
No! Uh-oh.
Drum roll.
Try again.
Guys, the suspense is just killing us.
I know. It's like
Americana?
Yes!
Yay!
Anna Gorka, I believe is her name. So, yes, she's the big winner tonight.
Yay!
And this, the jewelry that she won is actually, if you noticed on Facebook, I don't know,
Kimberly Walters posted a picture of the same earrings that were actually used in the show. So the earrings she won this week not only were, they're not exact earrings, but they're the same kind that were worn in the show, but they were also donated by Kimberly Walters. So we thank her for that very much.
So if you are interested in winning any of the pieces, just keep an eye on Twitter, Tumblr, and Facebook, our Facebook page, the Black Petticoat Society Facebook page, and then on the tags for Black Petticoat Society on Tumblr and Twitter, and at Chris's blog, SwissChris355, is a good place to find that stuff. And also, if you don't happen to win, like I said, you know, Kimberly's jewelry can be found on her website, and so you can purchase anything you like from there. And she's a fantastic lady, and all of the proceeds from sales of her jewelry go to benefit her rescue horses, and so it's a good cause as well as a fantastic product. So we're so happy to have her partnering with us in this and doing this with us. I guess I was kind of stalling because the next thing I want to just say, you know, we talked about this a little bit, and we couldn't close out tonight without saying a little something about what happened over this weekend. And we just want to express our profound sorrow over the events in Orlando, Florida, and we want to send love to anyone and everyone who has been affected in any way by what has occurred. It's so hard to know what to say. I really don't know what to say, but we didn't want to say nothing because it's important for people to know that you have allies and people who love you and people who care about you, and that hatred is not going to win. It's not something that will conquer the hearts of those people who are courageous enough to stand up and speak in favor of love and kindness and acceptance and understanding. Tragic things are inexplicable. They're incomprehensible. They are unfair, unjust, and they are heartbreaking. But we want everyone to know that there are always good people in the world, just as there are wicked people in the world. And you have to look to those people who are offering kindness and love, because those people are out there. And we just want to say from the bottom of our hearts, we're sending love to Orlando and to everybody around the world who has in any way been affected by anything that has happened in this horrible, horrible tragedy. So, ladies, anything else you guys wanted to add?
The good people outnumber those. What I want to say, I cannot say on here. I don't think we have a long enough censor beep, but screw that. Oh, I'm trying to censor myself. I'm not doing a very good job. I really do not have the words for this. It's senseless, disgusting, despicable. I just can't. I'm sorry. I can't.
No one should have to experience this. No one should have to experience this, you know. And I think the more that we join together and just, you know, just be kind to a complete stranger, that's how we can just spread it, you know, just despite them, because no one should have to deal with that. If you could put a smile on someone's day, then you're good. Good.
And I think the one thing that maybe we should remember is that we all have a tremendous amount of capacity for goodness in our hearts, and we should share that with each other every day and not forget and not hesitate and not wait to tell people how we feel about them, because goodness, kindness, love are infectious. hate is a parasite, and it's not going to thrive in a place where love exists. And there's a lot of love in the world. There's a lot of goodness in the world. It may not seem that way, and I may not feel that way all the time, but there's a tremendous amount of good. So for anyone listening, you know, we just wanted to share some words on this because, you know, even though it's hard to, we struggle through what to say, it's important to talk about it, I think, because it's important for people to know that they have allies and they have, you know, people who care and people who are not going to keep their mouth shut and pretend like things aren't happening. We want to stand up for the good and the right, peace, acceptance, love, compassion, all of those things for all people, for all people. Okay, ladies, well, I'm so happy to have all of you with me this evening. We're going to come back next week. We want to thank everybody so much for joining us, and we want to wish you just peace and love, and we will see you all very soon. Bye.
Bye-bye.